Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
And we are joined by a very special friend from Media Matters for America, Hannah Groach Begley. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you for having me.
Now, usually we have a number of the week where somebody guesses it, but I think this one was unanimous that we had to bring up $101,000. And can you explain why that's our number of the week?
Sure. CBS has just put out a new show called The Briefcase.
And The Briefcase. Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. And the premise of the show is that they take two families who are impoverished in America, and they give each family a single briefcase containing $101,000. And the decision that the families have to make is whether or not they're going to keep this money for themselves or share some or all of the money with another impoverished family that they don't know about. It's totally anonymous. They just have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to give this money to this other family. And throughout the course of the show, what happens is they end up finding out more and more about this family, this anonymous family. They start learning about their situation. And so it becomes harder and harder to make this decision, theoretically, for these people about whether or not they deserve to keep the money themselves or give it to these other people who are also needy. And then at the end, they meet each other, and it turns out that both families are giving each other the money. And so if they decided to give up money, then maybe they're getting money from this other family, though they don't know this. It's a big surprise at the end.
So they're both given a briefcase of $101,000, but neither family knows the other was
exactly
also given a briefcase.
Yeah, they think that they're the only ones in this situation and that they're going to help out this other family. And it turns out the other family is also potentially going to help them out if they decide to share the $101,000.
And it becomes a whole economic and emotional manipulation and exercise.
Absolutely. It's awful. I watched an episode this morning, I think the first episode that's aired, and it is, I think, what my friends used to refer to as the Oppression Olympics.
Oh God, that's exactly right.
I think that fits in here. That essentially what the show becomes is this question about who deserves to not be poor more, which is this awful situation to put families in. No family should ever have to make a choice about whether or not they are more or less deserving of poverty than another family. Like, it's really quite disgusting, to be honest. And it sets up this like incredibly weird situation that, you know, in the course of the show is treated with, you know, oh, it's so much empathy, it's so much sympathy. You know, these families are, you know, trying to think through like the loss that they've had and the loss that other people have had. And it really just becomes this great way to highlight inequality in America and how sort of screwed up the system is that people are even thinking that they should go through a reality show of this nature.
And, you know, our colleague Chelsea Keeney here at CAP, who's our media coordinator, she actually wrote a column for talkpoverty.org about the show and had a really similar take to what you just described. And she made, I thought, several really good points, but one in particular, which was the same takeaway I had in hearing about the show for the first time, which was how similar it is to the reality of our national budget process and how in this time of sort of artificial austerity and obsession with deficit reduction, we, our policymakers, I should say not we, but our policymakers have been literally pitting one group of struggling Americans against another literally daily as part of the budget process, saying, should we be cutting food stamps or should we be cutting Social Security? Should we be cutting benefits for veterans or should we be cutting nutrition assistance for poor children and so forth and so on, and really kind of forcing struggling individuals and the groups that represent them and their interests to fight against each other for table scraps while we've got the wealthiest in this country taking home 95% of the income gains that we see. So I'm on a soapbox. I will dismount. But that to me is sort of what this show most perfectly symbolizes.
And actually, to that point, last week we talked about the difference between what a CEO makes and the average worker. And we spent a little time talking about how members of the media, the CEOs of companies such as CBS, actually make a lot more than other CEOs. And I know that I was looking this up, but Les Moonves, the CBS CEO, makes $54 million. So we have this show where he's talking about these are tough times that are testing Americans. And yet CBS is complicit in the sort of income inequality we're seeing, where CEOs are making 373 times that of the average worker.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that, you know, when I went in to watch the episode, I tried to keep an open mind because there was a part of me that thought, you know, a show of this nature could actually be really interesting because it could go into the issues you guys are talking about, right? Like, one of the things that happens in the episode that I saw is one of the couples, one of the husbands is a disabled veteran. The other couple has three kids. You know, one of the couples is trying to build a new home. They're about to have a baby. There are all these very real policy issues that this connects to, right? Like, who is more deserving? Is a veteran more deserving than, you know, a man who can't work because he's an ice cream truck vendor and it's the middle of winter and no one wants to buy ice cream? You know, like, those are horrifying distinctions that our policymakers do make on a daily basis. And, you know, the show could address those things. It could address, you know, it's really hard to have three kids in America today, even if both parents are working. And in the show, both adults have jobs. The other couple, I think the one of them is working and one can't because he's a disabled veteran and he can't find work. You know, we could be talking about those issues. What are the causes of these people's poverty? Why are they here? Why are they on a reality show like this? And instead, we're like making them jump through even more hoops. We're making them, you know, prove their poverty to each other in order to get these assistance. And we already do that. We already do that when you know, if you need to get food stamps, if you need to get any assistance, you know, we make people jump through ridiculous hoops, and, you know, state legislators are trying to make that even harder. And you're absolutely right. You know, I think that the media plays a huge role into this. And, you know, CBS, obviously, this is an entertainment outlet. They're trying to make this entertaining. It is, you know, very heartstring pulling. I, you know, was tearing up a little, like, you know, it's a very well done show. But, you know, one of the things that I look at Media Matters a lot is news media and how they also play into this. And one of the things that we've seen that's really horrifying is that they're also using, you know, impoverished people in America as entertainment. You have news packages about, oh, here's a surfer in California who gets food stamps, and let's spend an hour talking about his life, and does he really deserve food stamps? And, you know, the fact that that is something that we have news organizations doing, you know, it almost doesn't surprise me that that someone at CBS thought this would be a good idea for a reality TV show.
A couple of weeks ago, we actually had on Mary O'Hara from The Guardian, who she's British, and she was talking a little bit about a show called Benefit Street, which is a show in the UK that, Hannah, I think you and I have talked about off air, where it's quite literally poverty porn, right? It is a camera on people's lives who are sort of manifesting the worst stereotypes about low-income people who need government assistance to make ends meet. Do you feel like that's what this show is? Is this show poverty porn?
You know, I think it definitely veers into that territory. You know, there's in the episode I watched, there was a part of the episode where the two families, they still don't really know about each other, but they're learning more and more about each other, and it's getting, you know, they're feeling more and more guilt about keeping the money, and they're getting to the point where they want to give more and more of the money away. And they go into each other's houses while the other families are out. And they're sort of looking through these people's clothing, their bills. You know, for the family that has a disabled veteran, you know, they see a bunch of his equipment that he requires. And it's it made me incredibly uncomfortable. Like, I believe that these people are needing of assistance. I believe that I don't need to see their dirty laundry to see that. I don't need to prove to the audience that they're really, really poor. We promise. Here, look at how their faucet doesn't work.
Right. And it perpetuates this whole idea that, you know, low-income people can't have nice things. If you have an iPhone, you have a television, like, you have to be in abject poverty in order to be deserving.
Exactly. And, you know, this is something we find a lot in particular conservative media is this idea that there's this myth like, oh, well, you know, poor people in America, like poor people are actually really well off, right? Because they have like refrigerators and microwaves.
The Robert Rector BS.
Yeah, they have things. And this is an actual quote from a Fox News host. And it is seared into my brain because it is so horrifying. And he says, you know, poor people in America, they have things. What they lack is the richness of spirit.
Right. We've talked about that on this show before,
and
right?
It's a classic quote because to me that embodies exactly what this show is trying to talk about, right? Because the whole point of the show is money doesn't really matter. What these people learn at the end of this journey is, you know, what really matters is that they're generous and giving and loving, and that this is the richness of spirit stuff that like, oh, that's what they find. And it's great that they end up with money at the end of the show too, but money really doesn't matter.
Right.
And I find that horrifying.
And actually, there was a study by the Chronicle of Philanthropy last year that said that low-income people give a higher percentage of their income to charity than higher-income people. And a friend of our show, Linda Torrado, she writes in her book how there was so much camaraderie. And it's like, so it's condescending, essentially, that this show thinks that they're teaching low-income people about generosity when studies show and just like common sense that low-income people are willing to come together and support each other and do that all the time.
Well, and the show kind of undermines, I think, its basic premise, because at the end of the episode I watched, at least, both families gave all of the money away to the other family, basically confirming no one deserves to be poor and everyone agrees with that, and we don't need to put on a big show to get to that conclusion. And one thing that I found, just a final point that I found was really interesting, is while I was watching the show, a commercial aired that was about how expensive college tuition is now. And I just thought it was so ironic. I was like, we're not talking about the causes of poverty in the show. We're not talking about like, what are the forces keeping these people down? We're talking about their richness of spirit. And it's so depressing.
Anna Groach-Begley from Media Matters for America. I wish we had a full hour to talk about The Briefcase, because I think we're all equally horrified, but we'll have to have you back soon to talk about other trends in the media that have to do with poverty.
I'd love to.
Thanks for being
here. Thanks so much. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm joined by Jared Bernstein, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and previously he served as Chief Economist and Economic Advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and was a member of President Obama's economic team. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So before we jump in to talk about your most recent book, we've had headlines recently talking about Janet Yellen announcing that later this year, it looks like we'll be raising the interest rate. And so I wanted you to help explain to us what that means and what it might mean to our economy.
Well, Janet Yellen is the chair of the Federal Reserve. And one of the jobs of the Federal Reserve is to fulfill what they call their dual mandate. So that's two-sided mandate. One is to keep the unemployment rate as low as they can, and the other is to make sure inflation doesn't start growing too quickly. So really, they're trying to hit something I actually write about a lot in my book, which is full employment. That is the lowest unemployment rate consistent with stable inflation. Now, our listeners may know the unemployment rate is pretty low right now. It's 5.4% last we checked, and that's awfully close to what the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen's organization, considers full employment. So it's not a surprise that they're thinking about raising interest rates, because they're worried that too much tightness in the economy and the job market could lead to an overheating on the price side. So that's just kind of the facts of the case. But the commentary is actually really, really important. And it redounds not just to financial markets, but to issues of income, of wages, of poverty. If the Federal Reserve intervenes too soon and slows the economy down, before, I would argue, a majority of people in the economy have a chance to benefit from an expansion, an economic expansion that's already 5.5, almost 6 years old, but hasn't reached everyone, I would argue that would be a big mistake. So the idea of raising rates too soon to fight really a phantom menace of inflation, because there really is no inflationary acceleration on the horizon, would be sort of a knee-jerk move by the Federal Reserve that could hurt more people than it would help.
I guess this leads nicely to your book, because your book is really about how more people can benefit from this expansion. And your book is called The Reconnection Agenda, Reuniting Growth and Prosperity. And, you know, before we even get to the content of the book, I just wanted to remark on the fact that we at Talk Poverty Radio understand that it's a challenge often to be entertaining and funny about such serious and important topics, but your book manages to do both.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to read a part that when I was reading it, I actually laughed out loud.
LOL'd?
I LOL'd, and I assume that some of our listeners, since our listeners are similarly wonkish people, might laugh as well. But you commented on the fact that people often say, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won, and you wrote, the first talking point about losing the war on poverty is just so patently wrong on the facts that anyone who says it should have to live in poverty for a while as a penalty for such obvious malfeasance. I loved that.
Thank you. Yeah, I wish we could do that. It might solve some of our rhetorical problems.
And so do you think that it's, I guess, going to that point, the rhetorical problems of discussing these issues, a lot more people are discussing poverty on both sides of the aisle. It's going to be a central issue in the election. How do you feel about the prospects of having productive conversations about whether it's, you know, reuniting growth and prosperity or poverty?
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad, and I sense you and maybe some of our listeners are as well, I'm very glad that more people, especially powerful people, are talking about this, are singing about it. But some are lip syncing and some are singing, and you have to know the difference. It's critically important. And in fact, I write about this in the book. This idea of a reconnection agenda is really a set of ideas. Every chapter describes some policies that would help, in my view, you know, based on lots of research, to reconnect the growing economy, GDP growth, productivity growth, and the incomes of the middle class, the incomes of the poor, something that has obviously been really quite severed over the last few decades. And this comes under the rubric of economic inequality. That is, you've got growth without prosperity. Now, this issue is so pervasive and so, I think, well understood that we're no longer arguing about whether it exists or not, whether inequality is a problem. We're more arguing what to do about it. And therefore, you've now got lots of conservatives, as you suggested, Tracy, getting into the mix and saying, I care about poverty, too. I care about the middle class, too. I care about wage stagnation as well. And that's why we have to. And there you have to really listen carefully, because if the end of that sentence is the same kinds of ideas that many of those were saying anyway, because they want to cut taxes on wealthy people or deregulate the economy or shut the EPA or whatever their idea is, that's not a reconnection agenda. That's just a rhetorical flourish where you say, I care about an issue that's on everybody's mind these days, and I want to do the same thing I was going to do anyway to help make it go away. What I've tried to do is write what I think is a real reconnection agenda. I don't think it's the only one. Other people can have good ideas, of course. I don't have a monopoly on good ideas, far from it. But I do believe that based on my understanding of the economy working in this field for many decades, these ideas would help reconnect.
Reflecting on your role on Obama's economic team, you write about how the smartest economists you know had expertise to restart the economy, but no one knew how to reconnect middle-class prosperity and overall growth. Why has this been such a challenge?
Right. I mean, the way I put what you just very correctly summarized from the book is, I said our toolbox doesn't have enough of the right tools in it. Myself and my colleagues back in the day when we were working on this really nightmarish Great Recession that the economy was in the grips of, was to get the macro economy growing again. Because without growth, you can't do much at all. So growth is necessary. The point of the book is that it's not sufficient to uplift the living standards of the people we're concerned about. For that, you need full employment, for example. That's one of the key themes of the book. We have to get the unemployment rate down to very, very low levels, not 5.4%, which, by the way, for technical reasons, is biased down anyway. The true unemployment rate would be higher than that. When the unemployment rate gets really low, as I show in the book, the benefits redound disproportionately to the lowest income people. For a 10% reduction in the unemployment rate, the wages of the lowest paid workers goes up 10%, of middle class workers, 4%, of rich workers, 90th percentile workers, 0%. It doesn't really help them much because they already have very low unemployment. And this may sound somewhat far afield, but it's actually very important. I talk about the trade deficit. The trade deficit has been a really big drag on growth, and it has hurt our manufacturers, and that's meant the absence of some important jobs for middle and even lower middle class people. I talk about, and this is very germane in a poverty conversation, I talk about the fact that there are literally tens of millions of people out there with criminal records. And they need and they want to get back into the labor market, but they're not getting a fair shake. So I talk about ideas to help them get a more fair chance to get into the job market. And in that context, I talk about how the government may have to be the employer of last resort. If we want to get to full employment and the private market isn't creating enough jobs, then it seems to me, just like we have the Federal Reserve as a lender of last resort when credit markets fail, we have to have the government as employer of last resort when labor markets fail. And there's more, but those are some of the big ones.
Actually, those are two policies areas that we've been working extensively on in terms of ensuring that we remove barriers to people with criminal records, but also the subsidized jobs piece of this.
Can you speak more about that?
So I had personal experience with that because that was our office under the vice president. We were responsible for helping to implement the Recovery Act from the White House. And that was a policy that I took particular interest in, as did the vice president. And in fact, we had this task force, the Middle Class Task Force, that did an event to highlight the success of this Subsidized Employment Act. It's called TANF Subsidized Jobs because it was under the TANF program. And one of the things we found was that this program had it would surprise me, had great bipartisan appeal. Haley Barbour, Republican governor at the time, loved this program. I think he did a TV commercial for us. Now, Congress got very austere, meaning that they shifted to a kind of deficit-reducing fiscal policy, and they got rid of the program way too early. But before it ended, it created employment opportunities for 250,000 people who probably wouldn't have had them anyway. And so one of the ideas in the book is to take that program to a national scale.
Right, and that, you know, through that program, people are gaining experience and can eventually move into unsubsidized employment.
And there's exactly. And in fact, some did. They moved from subsidized to unsubsidized employment. And that's a very important point, Tracy. I'm glad you made it. But I want to say that there's a macroeconomic point in here that I don't want to lose, which is that left to itself, we happen to have a very strong and very flexible macro economy in this country. We're doing much better than many other countries, even despite a very gridlocked political situation. However, I have become convinced from doing this work that left to its own devices, I don't think we'll get to full employment. I think there are corners of the labor market. We talked about people with criminal records. We could also talk about the long-term unemployed. We could talk about long-term victims of discrimination. There are folks who will not be reached by a 5% unemployment rate or even lower. And for those folks, an idea like subsidized jobs is very important. Now, you have to be mindful of how you do it. There are displacement issues. You don't want to just replace an incumbent worker with a subsidized worker. So there's wrinkles that you need to be mindful of. But I do think that's an important idea.
And I want to jump back to something that you mentioned briefly. You talked about trade. Mm. And Congress has been considering legislation to give the president trade promotion authority, which would give him the ability to fast track a controversial trade deal around the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why does this matter for American workers?
Well, I explained that in Chapter 5 of the book. And I must say, I probably rewrote that chapter more than any of the other ones because a lot of what's in there is less intuitive than some of the other chapters. And I'm not saying it's any good because I can't judge that, but I did put some sweat into it and I commend it to readers. We should mention, by the way, that you can get this book free online. So that's, I hope, a feature. And I tackle that question therein. I think the connection to the reconnection agenda is through this thing called the trade deficit. Every year since the mid-1970s, so, you know, well over 35 years, we've bought more from other countries than we've sold to them. We've imported more than we've exported. Our trade deficit has been 4%. It's averaged about 3% of GDP, negative, 3% of GDP since the year 2000. Now, that is a very big drag on growth. Now, I realize I'm jumping to the macro, and a lot of people, especially in a poverty conversation, think, what does that have to do with us? When your economy is carrying around a weight of 3%, an anvil around its figurative neck of 3% of GDP, it is that much harder to get to full employment. And we can't get to full employment if we're going to have trade deficits of that magnitude year in, year out. One important reason why we have those deficits is because some of the countries with whom we trade manage their currencies in order to get an edge over us. They make their exports to us very cheap, and they tax our exports to them. And the reason the TPP is controversial, this trade agreement that you're talking about, Trans-Pacific Partnership, the reason that's controversial is because it doesn't do anything about that, and it should. I'm not a staunch opponent of the TPP. I frankly, nobody's read the TPP because it's been negotiated in secret. So what I've been able to read, WikiLeaks leaked a chapter. What I've been able to read, I didn't love, but I didn't hate. It's all very complicated legal stuff. Some of it's free trade, some of it's protectionist. What's not in there is a currency chapter, something that would have enforceable disciplines against this kind of problem. That would help us reduce our trade deficit and get more to full employment. That would help reduce poverty.
So throughout this conversation, we've been touching on things that might have to do with more with middle class. At some points, we're talking specifically about poverty. What I like about your book is that you talk about both. You talk about people at all income levels. How does your agenda ensure that we're helping all people regardless of their income level?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the answer to the question comes down to this issue of inequality. It's not that the nature of this unequal growth problem that we have feeds into an immobility problem and a wage stagnation problem that only hurts the poor, that is fine by the middle class, but bad for the poor, or good for the poor and bad for the middle class. It's really difficult and challenging economically these days. And in fact, this was the motivation for the book, for the vast majority of households out there. I mean, there is the prosperity that we've been generating has been very narrowly shared. It's accumulated at the very top of the scale. It doesn't mean that the poor haven't gotten anything. In fact, our transfer system is working pretty well by some measures. It doesn't mean that the middle class is falling behind year after year, but it does mean, for example, the statistics bear this out, that middle class incomes are lower now than they were before the recession. I mean, if you think about that, they really haven't gone anywhere since 2000.
And that 95% of the growth that we've experienced has gone to the 1%.
Most of the growth has gone to the 1%. Most of the growth within the 1% has gone to the top 10th of the top 1%. So there is no division between middle and poor. The division is between, roughly speaking, haves and have-nots, and the have-nots are pretty much everybody. And I don't, again, to be, I'm using loose language for an economist, have-not doesn't mean nothing has reached you. In fact, as I've mentioned, Social Security, the earned income credit, nutritional supports, housing vouchers, some of these programs have really done important work. And as an economist at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, we work to support and extend some the reach of some of those programs. But there should be a real unification of everyone on the wrong side of the inequality divide, regardless of what percentile you're at.
And so before I let you go, you mentioned earlier that conservatives are increasingly talking about inequality and poverty, but are advocating for the same old policies. But you also seem to have faith that despite the fact that we're in a hyper-partisan environment where anything that, you know, Obama's name might be connected to, people oppose regardless of its merits, you seem optimistic that the agenda that you lay out is something that could pass, that could be adopted, at least aspects of it. Why do you think that's possible?
Well, first of all, I think I'm congenitally optimistic because if I wasn't, I would be in the wrong line of work in the wrong city at the wrong time. And secondly, I certainly don't think any of this has legislative traction at the federal level in the near term. Realistically, of course, that's the case. One chapter I devoted to things that states are doing. And I think that I enjoyed writing that chapter because, you know, states have to do stuff. The governors have to do, they have to deal with a university system. They have to deal with infrastructure. They have to deal in many cases with more pressing poverty. They can't take, you know, 56 ideological votes against Obamacare that aren't going anywhere. So I look at the state agenda, and the history of this country does sometimes suggest that good ideas bubble up from the states. Bad ideas do too, and I have them in there. Right to work, for example, an anti-union idea. So a big part of the answer to your question is, of course, the long game. Pendulum swing back, and it's my view that if we can align our thinking, and again, I'm not just thinking of progressives. I'm thinking of anyone who's not in the top, 1, 2, or 3% of the income scale. If we can align our thinking around a set of ideas that don't necessarily have ideological name tags on them. So full employment. Full employment is not a liberal idea, by the way. Full employment is something that a lot of people want. We'll have liberal conservative ideas about how to get there. Lowering our trade deficit. That's something that a lot of people want. Investing in infrastructure. That never used to be such a partisan issue. So I think that the idea is to just look past the current gridlock and partisanship as the foolishness that it is. I mean, you have to live with it and you have to try to deal with it in real time. And I do that in my day job. But in a book that tries to have a longer vision, You look past it and you try to think about unifying the folks who have been disenfranchised by the kind of unequal economic growth we've seen. They really need a reconnection agenda, and I'm offering this up as one.
Our guest is Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and formerly of President Obama's economics team. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tracy.
And you mentioned the book is free. Where can people find the book?
Probably the best place is to go to my blog, jaredbernsteinblog.com, and you'll see it right there on the first page of the blog.
Great. Thanks so much, and we'll have to have you back.
Thanks, Tracy. My pleasure.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm here with Jamal Bowie, a staff writer at Slate covering politics, policy, and race. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So obviously a lot of the news has shifted away from Baltimore, but I actually wanted to start there. I spoke with actually a mutual friend of ours, Janae Desmond-Harris at Vox.com recently, and she brought up your piece, The Deep Troubling Roots of Baltimore's Decline. And, you know, she and I discussed how in Baltimore, the mayor is black, half the police force is black, the city council chair is black. And so some people are saying, well, clearly this isn't a race issue, but your piece walks us through how this isn't the case. Can you explain?
Right. So it's funny when people say that this, you know, can't be a race issue and they point to sort of descriptive representation. And what's sort of misleading about descriptive representation, it's just that, descriptive. It doesn't really do anything substantive. It's certainly nice. No one's going to complain that they have people who look like them leading their city, but it doesn't touch the deep-rooted things. And the thing about Baltimore is that in its 20th century history, it was basically a pioneer for the kind of housing discrimination and redlining that we saw kind of throughout American metropolises in the 20th century. So, for example, one of the nation's first segregation ordinances was passed in Baltimore in, I think, 1911 and 1912. It was bolstered by private organizations dedicated to ensuring that African Americans and Jews stayed out of old line white Baltimore neighborhoods. That kind of approach to housing in the city persisted basically for 50 or 60 years. So in the 1930s, when the federal government is creating new housing projects, they're placing the buildings in areas that were cordoned off in the 1910s. And in turn, in the 1950s, they're doing urban renewal and removing tens of thousands of African-American residents in the same kinds of places that were redlined and cordoned off in the 1930s and 20s and 10s. And so when we get to the present day, to say nothing of, say, the 70s or the 80s or 90s, what we're really looking at is the consequences of patterns of racial change, of white flight, of deliberate disinvestment. One, I wouldn't call it a funny story, but it's kind of like, that's really terrible, is in the 1960s, as the city of Baltimore was becoming blacker and the counties were kind of hemorrhaging or taking in lots of white residents, I mean, lots of Jewish residents who could afford to leave and find places where they could live. It used to be that if you wanted to commute into the city, into the county, or vice versa, there was a trolley line that was heavily used. Something like 40% of traffic in and out of the city was by way of this trolley line. As the city became blacker, mysteriously, the trolley line was less reliable, came fewer times, ended up becoming so unreliable that people who could drive decided to start driving or purchase cars or what have you. In this kind of phenomenon, the deliberate disinvestment out of communities that were becoming blacker and to a similar but limited, much more limited extent as time was going on, communities that were becoming more Jewish in the area had an impact such that, you know, you get to the 1980s, and you have chunks of the city that are boarded up and roads are unpaved. And that's a deliberate decision. That's not just because people didn't care. That's because the city no longer had the resources, or 20 years earlier had said, black people live there, we're not going to do anything about it there.
Yeah, and I know that you're a fan of the research done by Patrick Sharkey. I know my producer will probably laugh because I quote his research a lot, but it's amazing. It's really startling facts that 70% of the African Americans that live in the poorest and most distressed neighborhoods today are the
children and grandchildren of those that lived in them 40 years ago. So, you know, as you're explaining that these policies created something that, yeah, we no longer have laws on the books for segregation, but that clearly we have, you know, de facto segregation. It's continuing.
Right. They created sort of forward momentum, or, you know, maybe to put it a little differently, if you're gardening and you create plots and rows, just because there's no longer any plants there doesn't mean those plots and rows go away. And the next season, even if you do little preparation, you may still get growth there. And that's sort of what we see with segregation. We sowed a landscape of deep-seated segregation, and we stopped sowing it. We said, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. But that doesn't change the fact that the landscape of the garden itself still exists, and we haven't yet to do anything to plow over it completely and plant something new.
And that brings me to another piece that you wrote recently called Whiteout, Why Integrating America's Neighborhoods and Cities is Harder Than We Think. And you write, for white homebuyers, race matters, not just as a proxy for class. So even though we're not, you know, it's not on the books anymore, people are still taking race into consideration. Could you, you know, explain to us what you found in your research for this piece?
Sure. So one of the kind of persistent questions about housing segregation is how much of it owes to just sorting. You know, you are African American, you want to live around other African Americans, you're white, you want to live around other white people. Because if it's just sorting, then it's hard to kind of, you know, it's hard to be that mad about it. People are just making choices. There's been a lot of research around this over the last 15 years or so. And what researchers have found is that for white Americans in particular, race acts as a signaling mechanism. And not like you said this, not for class. They found this through experiments where they essentially asked people to rate different kinds of neighborhoods, you know, middle class, upper class, lower middle class, so on and so forth. And each neighborhood had either a mix of people, black and white, all black or all white. And white respondents consistently would rate upper class black neighborhoods lower than their white equivalents, saying things like there's probably more crime there, the schools are probably worse, so on and so forth. What they think and what I think is that this reflects the extent to which mortgage markets, when they were constructed in the 1930s, were constructed around the idea that certain races and ethnic groups were less desirable than others to be around. And mortgage decisions, lending decisions rather, were made on that basis. And this became not only the basis of the federal mortgage market, but private lenders also began operating this way too. And they operated this way for pretty much 60 years. And so it just kind of became a deep-seated part of how mortgage markets worked. And so if you're a white home buyer, who's probably coming from a place that's relatively segregated, all of this is kind of it's in the air. You're not consciously thinking about it, but it's in the air, and it influences how you perceive things. You, all your life, a good neighborhood has been defined as one that's like suburban and mostly white. And so when you see a neighborhood that's mostly black, you, in the back of your mind, think maybe this isn't a good neighborhood. And I should say, this is true of African Americans as well. Like these things, because they exist in the air of the United States, no one's immune to them. And so what ends up happening is, it becomes very hard to encourage integration because for a non-trivial number of people, if you ask them, would you want to live in a neighborhood that, you know, the median income is $100,000, but half your neighbors are going to be black, they'll be like, absolutely not.
So recently, I went back to my hometown of Oakland and did a segment on gentrification. And there's been a lot of articles written about gentrification and even studies saying that millennials have higher, I guess, tolerance for living near ethnic and racial minorities, which even just stating it that way, it sounds like millennials are all white. But in these kinds of conversation about gentrification, how do we reconcile that in the context of these other issues of, okay, you know, white people don't want to have homes in black neighborhoods, but also we're seeing all these studies that's kind of what they're doing.
So one thing worth noting about the kinds of places that are gentrifying in Oakland, in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, most notably, is that these are places that have large African-American minorities, but they aren't necessarily majority African-American. And there's been some recent research to suggest there's actually a threshold that past around 30 or 35% black, a neighborhood becomes much less likely to gentrify, that there still needs to be some sizable threshold of white residents, low income usually, but they have to be there for the gentrification process to kind of take its full flight. And this kind of relates to the fact that gentrification also doesn't tend to happen as much when affluent blacks are moving to lower income black neighborhoods. You would think that if this is just a matter of income, then it wouldn't really matter. But being a white pioneer in a low income neighborhood has a certain cultural cachet attached to it, that lenders see that, business owners see that, and they say, you know, this is an area ripe for opportunity. And a just as affluent college educated black professional doing the same doesn't bring that same thing, which is troubling because there is, you know, in my mind, there's good gentrification, there's bad gentrification. Good gentrification is gentrification where the neighborhoods become better and that this growth is equitably distributed through way of sort of modest housing prices, through new jobs for existing residents, and so on and so forth. And that kind of gentrification is more likely to happen in places where you do have genuinely diverse groups of people moving into neighborhoods. When it becomes speculative, as what happens when white affluent white, and I hate the term gentrifier because it puts the agency on the person moving in, who often is just looking for a place to live. They're not saying to themselves, man, I want to kick out all these people. They're like, I can afford an apartment here, and so that's where I'm going to live. It's not market forces. It's policy that we've set in place that leads to this transformation. And part of the challenge for revitalizing urban spaces is to kind of both show business owners and lenders and cities that you want to make these sort of investments when any kind of educated person is moving in, but also to say that we need to structure our housing policies to accommodate this new growth and to be able to distribute it to the people who are already living there.
And so, shifting gears a little bit, because obviously race has been weaved throughout the conversation we've been having so far, it's the 40th anniversary of the Moynihan Report, which essentially blamed the disproportionate level of poverty on quote unquote, like ghetto culture, or this, you know, we hear that this actually in the narratives of politicians today with, you know, Paul Ryan talking about inner city men, his, you know, dog whistling term. But given the fact that African-Americans and other people of color are disproportionately poor, how do you think that we can more productively talk about this? Because it is a problem, but how can we talk about it without getting into this kind of cultural pathology?
The interesting thing about the Moynihan Report is that Moynihan does two rhetorical things. First, he says, listen, the current state of black neighborhoods, of black communities, is entirely a function of white treatment of black Americans. That the only reason why black Americans are in these conditions is because white society has been utterly terrible. Then he says, from there he says, that treatment has created a cultural pathology that reinforces the things that white society sowed. That's, I think, that kind of turn towards sort of saying the pathology reinforces the structure is what's controversial, and I think we should walk away from, because I'm not sure that it's true. I'm not sure that's a thing that you can empirically show is the case. But I do think that Moynihan's initial insight that we're just reaping the conditions created a long time ago. And those conditions are, you know, deliberately destabilizing families, unstable labor markets, so on and so forth. Those are important insights. And they're replicated, you know, a couple decades later by William Julius Wilson, The Truly Disadvantaged. And Wilson's argument that what Moynihan is describing is what just happens when you do that to a population, in any pathology that exists ultimately traces back to those initial material conditions. I think that's true, and I think you see it in white rural communities where kind of the same conditions have popped up, no jobs, no opportunity, and all of a sudden people are doing drugs and killing each other because there's really nothing else. I think moving forward, we need to start talking about it in those terms and saying, in essence, that these are not black problems. These are problems of low opportunity and sort of deliberate disconnection from mainstream economies. And they're not just happening to black people. They're happening to millions of Americans who are in similar situations. And so that's how we push back on the idea that this is, because I think the pathology argument is at its core an argument about how this is a black problem. And there's nothing wrong with black people that couldn't be fixed by like undoing the damage of the past.
And one of the things that I enjoy about all of these pieces that you've written that we've been talking about is this historical context that you bring to modern day policy debates and problems. And one of the more interesting things that you're doing now is a podcast. For is the podcast the only or the first one of the Slate Academy?
Yeah, it's the first of the Slate Academies.
And so it's on the history of American slavery, and you guys have branded this as the college course you wish you'd taken. Can you explain what this is and why you wanted to do a podcast on this subject?
Sure. So my co-host, it's like I'm the co-host and she is like the host, Rebecca Onion. She's a historian by training, but she's not a 19th or 18th century historian. She's a 20th century historian, and she didn't know a ton about slavery. I am a bit of a Civil War and Reconstruction geek, but I sort of only know about slavery as much as it's necessary to know to be a geek about these other things. And so both of us were like, we would like to know more about American slavery, and not just sort of in broad strokes, but very much the nitty-gritty details, like how did slavery change as an institution? How did enslaved people themselves understand their place in slave societies? And how did white Americans understand their place? And so this really was an opportunity for us to scratch our own curiosity, and we enlist a lot of great historians and experts to sort of help us explore, and in the process help our listeners explore slavery from roughly the beginning of the 16th century to just after the Civil War.
Our guest is Jamel Bowie, staff writer with Slate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. At Talk Poverty, we often ask ourselves, what's wrong with the way that America's fighting poverty? If you ask Linda Tirado, it's the way that political elites are obsessed with social issues and exclude poor people from the conversation. In a recent article she wrote for TalkPoverty.org, she argues that we must put our partisan bickering aside, focus on economic issues, and let poor people lead the way. We sit down with her to discuss this thesis.
Linda, thanks for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
I am super excited to be here.
you sound super excited.
You don't sound very excited.
But I am chipper.
And we make you come by the office a lot. So
yeah, no, and I am. Everybody is dressed down, and I feel overdressed because there are so many clothes that I could have worn today and didn't.
Well, so why did we bring you in here? You had a Talk Poverty column last week. And tell us a little bit about what the piece was about.
Mostly about the idea that if we want to deal with poverty and class issues, we can't ignore half of the country that are in poverty and have issues economically.
Say what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, about half of the people who live in poverty are Republicans or conservatives, and half of them are liberals, and that's all well and good, but you can't say that you care about a marginalized community if half of them have politically unacceptable beliefs and you're not willing to fight for them. I mean, it doesn't actually matter what anybody's thoughts on abortion are. When they're at McDonald's, they need, like, actual safety equipment, and they need a living wage, and they need sick leave, and they need workplace protections and collective bargaining and all of these things, which isn't to say that social issues aren't important, but they are largely irrelevant to the workplace. And so when we're talking about things like economic equality, I'm more worried that my crew is not being physically harmed than I am that they have enough time to talk about their moral and political beliefs.
So there's plenty of leaders out there that are, you know, conservative or progressive who would say, you know, I'm advocating for economic policies I believe in. I do want to help all people regardless of their political background. Why do you feel like that's not really resonating with people? You know, I think we could point to members of Congress who are saying, I am fighting for all people.
Yeah, I think that people who wear blazers to work every day just aren't going to understand what it's like to wear a polyester work shirt. And those are fundamentally different things. So there is nothing that doesn't have a strong economic argument. Like, the economy intersects with every issue. When we're talking about reproductive justice, we can talk about life outcomes in not being able to access birth control or having to pay for it, or the cost that somebody will incur of having a child that they maybe didn't want, that they couldn't access an abortion. Those things have an economic impact. When you're talking about gay marriage and being able to, you know, put your spouse on your insurance, like, those things have an economic impact. So what gets me, and I think the conversation that I'm trying to have is if we know that everything has an economic impact, why don't we focus narrowly on the things that we know everybody agrees on? And then from there, we can kind of spread out. Because if we can get collective bargaining, we have won gay marriage, because people are going to be able to go to their employers and say, we are going to put our spouses on our insurance. This is going to be part of our contract. We do that at enough businesses. And then we get business owners going to the government and saying, we need to standardize this. We need to make this uniform. It is a tactic to get to these social issues that nobody has thought of, because I think largely people think everybody's like them. And it's adorable that city people think that like those skills are going to work out in the rurals. But honey, there is a huge swath of America that people are entirely ignoring.
I want to push back just a little bit, and I want to ask a question that hopefully will help me understand where you're identifying the problem as. Mm. So the minimum wage is maybe a great example,
sure.
Right? So overwhelmingly, hugely popular. Every time we poll people on it, we're talking like 70%, 80% of Americans across party lines, across income levels, everybody wants to raise the minimum wage. And we see when it comes to ballot referendums and other popular measures, it passes, right? Red states, blue states. But when you look at our elected officials, it really does come down across party lines. And so we've got progressives saying, yes, let's raise the minimum wage. And then we've got conservatives in most cases opposing raising it, and in some cases even saying we shouldn't even have a federal minimum wage. So who's the problem here?
Anybody who has ever cracked an economics textbook that thinks a zero minimum wage would work is a huge problem. But no, I think that the trouble that we're running into is, look, we know that if the top 10% of wage earners in the business lobby want something and the rest of America wants something opposed, we know how people vote. We have that data. And not just Congress, but all the way down into the down ballots and local elections, like money, power, influence, they are things that we always have to deal with. But I think what people are forgetting frequently is that we still live in a country where the workers are getting $15 and a union, and our national democratic leadership is introducing 12 or 10-10 and no union. So I honestly think that we can say the people on the ground know what they need, and they are going out and they are getting it. The disconnect is that folks aren't asking us, what are you guys willing to do? What do you need? Because I'll tell you what, if you had come to me when I was working at Burger King, the first thing I would have said is, I need my workers to be able to file for workers' comp without fear of retaliation. And those laws are on the books. They are never enforced. There are no teeth to those laws. And I think that if people understood that that is reality outside of the power structure, then we could get some work done. So, you know, I think the disconnect is really just one of experience.
So I want to go back to what you were saying about the examples of abortion and LGBT rights. I'm really glad that you clarified that these are economic issues. But it seems that the way that your piece frames them is that you're kind of conceding it to the rights rhetoric of it being social issues. So how would you respond to communities that are saying, this is so central to my, you know, economic progress?
Two or three things. The first is, it's interesting to me that other people are allowed to do identity politics, but we can never have class as our first identity. We can never say, I am low income, I am poor. What I am fighting for is the kind of broad justice that will affect everybody positively. Secondly, I think it's remarkably largely dismissive of the fact that half of the country does not agree with us on these issues, period, the end. We can rail about how immoral that line of thinking is. We can talk about how illogical and unethical and counterproductive it is to not believe in reproductive justice when we know the data shows us that it's an economic issue. But the fact remains that a good portion of the country, we only just now got to over half the country being approving, right? Just now. So if you're trying to make a broad movement, if you are trying to talk on behalf of all of the poor and not just the poor that already morally agree with you, you have to understand that you're going to be working with these folks who believe as strongly as you do. Like, I'm from Utah, dude. This is a religious state, a hugely religious state. These are folks who really, truly, honestly believe in God. And they really, truly, honestly believe that God wants them to vote against abortion in every case. Does that have anything to do with whether or not they should be able to see a doctor if they get cut on the meat slicer? I don't actually think so. I think that if we work with folks on the meat slicer issue, and then we come to them and say, look, we're not, what are the slurs we hear? Baby killer, we hear all of those words, right? It's yelled outside abortion clinics. What if those people already were working with us? What if they knew us as human beings? What if we had already established a path for discussion? And then we explain to them why it's an economic issue, why, yes, we shouldn't be encouraging people to go out and have abortions, but we should absolutely give everybody the right. And more to the point, if you want to be anti-abortion, let's get birth control. Let's get real sex ed. Let's reduce the need. And then we don't have to have that fight so frequently because it won't be the only option, right? And so when we can have those discussions across these huge divisive boundaries, because what we're seeing, everybody's going to knee-jerk. Everybody's going to say, well, I'm for a woman's right to choose. It's an economic issue. It is hugely personal to me. And somebody else is going to say, look, I am pro whatever my religious or personal or ethical beliefs are, and this is hugely important to me. And there is no way to overlap there. But if you can overlap on a different issue, then you have built those relationships. I think it is another way. I think being willing to make these issues not the forefront, not the focus, not take them away, not give up on them, just look, if you're in a room with, you know, somebody that you know does not agree with you on this, maybe don't make that the first thing you say at dinner. You just, you have a discussion about the things you have in common. In my neighborhood, I have talked a bunch of my neighbors around to a lot of economic justice issues. And the way I do that is go, look, you and I don't agree on gays. We don't agree on abortion. We don't agree on policing in America. We don't agree on all of these hot button issues. I'm going to come for you on those later. Trust. Like, we are not dropping this discussion. All right. Like, and I will hit you hard on them.
Linda Tirado is coming for you.
It's true. I'm coming for everybody. Hello.
She has a pitchfork in her hand too, in case you can't see that from the.
No. Don't tell people I have a pitchfork. Then they'll know where the armory is. Like, come on, dude. But I mean, if we can do that, right? And we have those conversations and I say, look, we don't agree on any of these things. So let's agree that we don't agree and we'll pick them up later. And oh, by the way, in the background, I'm going to be writing op-eds on these issues. And I know that you're going to be writing op-eds on these issues. And that's cool. We can have that fight simultaneously, just not in this particular discussion. This one time, we are going to center workers. This one discussion, workers are going to be center. And not the whole life of a worker, but the workplace life of a worker is going to be centered here. And to have people say that we can't do that, I wonder why not? Because we do center these other issues so frequently. Why is somebody's work identity not allowed to be centered sometime?
So a component of your piece and a central component of your piece that I really liked and which I felt doesn't get talked about enough was that we're not talking about some small percentage of the population here when we talk about poverty and economic hardship. We're talking about most Americans. Right, you make the point that two-thirds of Americans are living literally paycheck to paycheck, right? And we could throw out a lot of other statistics that, you know, if you look longitudinally, things that we talk about on the show a lot, that poverty is a mainstream experience when mm-hmm. you look at the likelihood of experiencing it at some point during your life. And I think that you roll that into your broader argument, I think, in a really powerful way, which is that we're not talking about us and them. We're talking about us, but that the disconnect is between policymakers and the rest of us experiencing that.
Yes.
Right? So how do we get to the point where policymakers get and understand that we're talking about most of the country here and that this is us and not them?
Three of the most hated words on the internet, check your privilege.
Wait, so unpack that.
So if we know that, say, two-thirds of Americans are going to be coming in and out of poverty, 45 million at any given time, then we absolutely know that a bunch of those folks are not going to agree with us on all of these issues. To ignore that is to erase the moral decision-making capability of these workers. It is to say, your opinions don't matter because I disagree with them, and I do not give you the moral standing or the respect that you deserve as a moral thinker because you've come to an opposite conclusion from me. And we do this without ever knowing what their lives are like, without knowing what their regions of the country are like, without knowing what it is to live on a farm or on a ranch or in a small town in the mountains. So when we are being that dismissive of half of the poor because we care about the poor so much, I say check your privilege.
Who's the we there when we are dismissive?
You know, I'm broadly the left.
Okay.
broadly the left, right? Because what the first thing you're going to hear when somebody is talking about these issues and saying we are focusing on this issue is, well, what about these other issues?
So something that I'd be interested in hearing a bit more about is what your vision of the anti-poverty movement really is in terms of all of these different components. You know, how do you see institutions like ours or other players in Washington being able to play some sort of role? Because, you know, obviously we provide research and data, but we also, I think, really value the lived experiences of people as well.
I think that the role of the large institutions is to stop assuming that they know best, because you have, once you've come to DC and set up an institution, you have already put blinders on yourself. You are not an institution in St. Louis. You're not an institution in Tuscaloosa. I think that when you build these kind of huge institutional premises, it's huge and fantastic and valuable, and we need that. We need them. But these groups and these institutions need to understand that they are partners and not leaders. There cannot be a leader in this movement. We are going to need tiny nonprofits from all over. We're going to need individual actors. We're going to need workers. We're going to need people that are online. We're going to need the huge institutional support. The institutions could be giving money to these tiny startups that don't have grant writers. The institutions could be supporting the efforts that we see that are valuable and working, right? And I think that that's the institutional role, is to be able to do the research and the data, because I don't have that capability. But you know what I'm really good at? Going out and talking to poor people and getting folks to organize. So,
and that's a lot of what we're trying to do with this show, is to bring in the voices of people who should be at the table.
Yeah, I think it's actually hugely valuable. So, like, it's why I love you guys so much. Is this is the thing. This is the thing that we need to be doing, because we break down the barriers when we talk across these lines.
Our guest is Linda Tirado, writer and friend of Talk Poverty and founder of Bootstrap Industries.
And check out her piece on talkpoverty.org. Thank you so much, Linda.
And you.
We look forward to having you back.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network, or probably on iTunes, because really, who has radios anymore?
And continue the conversation with us on Twitter using the hashtag TalkPoverty and tweet directly at us with the handle @TalkPoverty.
Special thanks, as always, go out to our co-executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman.
And our fantastic intern, Will Strom.
Also the press team and the poverty team.
And as always, our friend, Chris Stiles Bacon.
Take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?